After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Obama's policies on the environment spelled the end for the coal industry. Now, President Trump is promising to restore thousands of coal jobs and do away with Obama's legacy on climate change. And this afternoon, Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May, delivers a letter to the head of the European Council, informing him that after 44 years of membership, her country is leaving the EU. It's Wednesday, March 29th.
I guess they like what we're about to sign. Huh?
The message was hardly subtle.
I knew they were going to like this one.
Coal miners
at the
Environmental Protection Agency.
I want to acknowledge the truly amazing people behind me on this stage, our incredible coal miners.
On Tuesday afternoon, President Trump went to the headquarters of the EPA to sign an executive order on environmental regulations.
We have a very, very impressive group here to celebrate the start of a new era in American energy and production and job creation. The action I'm taking today will eliminate federal overreach.
An executive order that directs the EPA to begin the legal process of repealing and replacing the Clean Power Plan, the centerpiece of President Obama's policies to fight global warming.
And allow our companies and our workers to thrive, compete, and succeed on a level playing field for the first time in a long time, fellas. It's been a long time.
So this was an incredibly striking image of these miners in front of the EPA. What's the message there?
President Trump gave the message loud and clear.
Come on, fellas.
Right before he signed the executive order today, he said,
basically, you know what this says? You know what it says, right? You're going back to work.
Come on, guys. You know what this is. You know what this is about. We're putting you back to work. And part of the message was it was about employment, but it was also clearly kind of intended to be a strike at President Obama's legacy.
Coral Davenport covers energy and the environment for The Times.
President Obama put forth this sort of set of sweeping environmental regulations that ended up defining his tenure. They became known as the war on coal, rightly or wrongly. That's kind of a mixed label. And President Trump referred to that many times. We're going to end the war on coal.
I've spent time with the miners all over America. They told me about the struggles they've endured.
This was about taking direct aim at a centerpiece of Obama's legacy and framing it as, you know, we're going to save you guys. We're going to bring you guys back.
That is what this is all about, bringing back our jobs, bringing back our dreams, and making America wealthy again.
And it was interesting because I got some emails from employees at the Environmental Protection Agency who were appalled at the signing today. They said, you know, President Trump has put forth a budget that would cut our jobs, cut our salary. You know, we've spent the last 2 or 3 years writing these regulations. Now he's come here and is basically signing these rules that are going to tell us to go back and undo what we've done. And he's brought not just coal miners, but coal executives, major donors from the coal industry.
I want to thank all of our industry leaders who are with us and who share our determination to create jobs in America for Americans.
So I think a lot of EPA employees sort of took it as a slap in the face.
Okay, so in the plainest possible terms, what did the executive order that Trump signed today do?
Well, a lawyer that I talked to said it basically has the legal impact of a tweet. The order itself didn't do anything, but it directed the EPA administrator to begin the extremely difficult and complex legal lift of rolling back President Obama's climate change regulations.
The miners told me about the attacks on their jobs and their livelihoods.
The heart of those regulations are aimed at global warming pollution from coal-fired power plants.
They told me about the efforts to shut down their mines, their communities, and their very way of life.
You're referring to the Obama Clean Power Plan.
That is the name the Obama administration gave to it, yes.
I am convinced that no challenge poses a greater threat to our future and future generations than a changing climate.
It set a target for each individual state to reduce their levels of greenhouse gas emissions from power plants.
Right now, our power plants are the source of about a third of America's carbon pollution. That's more pollution than our cars, our airplanes, and our homes generate combined.
And then it told states, you can come up with whatever way you want to reduce these emissions. That's up to you. You can get creative. But the targets were so strict and stringent that ultimately the way that they would be met would be by shuttering coal plants, mm-hmm. not building any new plants, and transitioning the entire American energy economy to renewable energy over the course of the coming decades.
So it sounds like if you're in the coal mining industry and if you work in that industry, you have every reason to have deeply feared the Obama Clean Power Plan, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in the long run, if the Obama Clean Power Plan were to be fully implemented, it would be a death knell for the coal industry. That said, the plan actually hasn't been implemented yet. It's been stayed by the Supreme mm-hmm. Court, which creates a complication for President Trump's promise to return these jobs to coal miners, because the reason that the coal industry has been declining is not the implementation of these regulations. It's really been changes in the market. Coal has become more expensive. Natural gas has become cheaper. Coal mining has become more automated. Those are all market forces that have been putting coal miners out of business. And so the bad news for them, a lot of economists say, is even if President mm-hmm. Trump succeeds in rolling back the power plan, most of those jobs actually aren't coming back.
Okay, so why take on this battle?
This battle became so ideological. These regulations, when the Obama administration put them out, kind of were a perfect storm. They were the Environmental Protection Agency putting forth regulations on the entire energy economy and for the cause of climate change,
right,
which is so politically weighted and so ideological when it comes to the discussion of science. And so, you know, for these reasons, it became such a popular target. You know, these were also the Obama administration's sort of offering to the rest of the world in forging a global warming accord, the Paris Agreement of 2015, in which nearly every nation on Earth committed to lowering carbon emissions.
So really quickly on the Paris Climate Agreement, which was a historic worldwide climate pact, what does the executive order that the president signed today do to the U.S. standing in that global agreement?
That is still an ongoing debate within the White House, a big one on should the U.S. stay in or should it pull out. But it essentially makes it impossible for the U.S. to meet its commitments under the Paris Accord. This is the United States saying, we're not even going to try. We're going to take this commitment and turn our backs on it, even if for the time being it remains committed in legal form.
President Obama's plan, and I remember this, Coral, from your reporting, went through the courts because it was challenged several times. Does that make it more legally secure now and therefore harder to unravel by President Trump?
There are a lot of pieces of the plan that have gone through the courts that have been challenged. Some elements of it actually have been upheld by Supreme Court decisions. Other pieces were still wending their way through the courts at the time of the election. And one possible outcome, which would be very bizarre, is that you would see the Obama plan, which is still awaiting a verdict in a federal court, and could still get appealed to the Supreme Court. Obama plan, climate plan working its way through the courts, and then a new Trump plan that would be put forward and challenged also working its way through the courts. And the courts, in the end, would be the entity that decides
which one is better.
Yeah.
So, Coral, we haven't even had a chance to talk about Scott Pruitt, who's the head of the Environmental Protection Agency and was chosen by Trump to dismantle regulations from inside his own agency in Washington. Would you come back this week to talk more about that?
I would love to. Scott Pruitt is a fascinating story.
It's a deal.
All right.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye, Coral. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Even a year ago, the idea seemed far-fetched. Today, it becomes reality. Britain begins formally removing itself from the European Union, becoming the first to abandon the 28-nation pact. Yes, I'm trying to reach Peter Goodman in room 301. 317, okay. Sorry, 317.
Okay.
Hello?
Peter Goodman, Michael Barbaro.
Oh, Michael Barbaro. My goodness, I'm hearing from the man himself. How are you?
Well, I made a couple minutes. You know, people put on my schedule. It was Peter Goodman, so I just canceled the afternoon.
That's great. That's how it should be.
Peter Goodman is a Times reporter in London. I called him a couple days ago in anticipation of today's news. Let's pretend it's Wednesday morning and the Daily drops, and if we were going to try to do a segment on Brexit that didn't feel too predictive and theoretical but could like grab hold of something that was compelling, like we just wanted to talk through what would make a compelling sounding segment on that.
I mean, you know, off the top of my head, this is a major moment in the breakdown of the post-World War II order.
At The Hague are gathered 800 delegates representing 23 European nations. Men and women of all walks of life have come to seek the first United States of Europe.
The logic post-World War II was, you take people who were predisposed to pick up guns and shoot one another across borders, and you turn them into trading partners, and then they're too busy making money and doing business to kill one another.
Calling a Europe desperately seeking a sign of hope amid a mass of war talk, Winston Churchill says,
"We cannot aim at anything less than the union of Europe as a whole, and we look forward with confidence to the day when that union will be achieved."
And that manifest itself in the Bretton Woods Agreement and the creation of the IMF and the World Bank and eventually the World Trade Organization. And a major piece of it was the integration of Europe.
A very good morning to you from Maastricht. It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 10th of December, 1991, and the day the European Community Heads of Government must take the critical decisions of what form European Union will take.
Which is essentially the largest consumer market on earth. I mean, it's a market that allows a company to set up a factory or a bank to set up a giant regional branch in London and sell its services from Ireland to Greece, a stretch of the globe that's got 500 million people in it, and to do that acting like it's one big country. And
the total number of votes cast in favor of leave was 82,000.
What British voters have done and what Prime Minister Theresa May has just actually executed is to say, actually, we're more interested in our own parochial interests here on this island nation.
This will be a defining moment for our whole country as we begin to forge a new relationship with Europe and a new role for ourselves in the world.
Yeah. And she's casting it in these global terms.
We will be a strong, self-governing, global Britain. Yeah. With control once again over our borders and our laws.
she's saying, well, actually, you know, the European Union is this stagnant place. And we want to start trading with India and China and focus on the United States and faster growing, more innovative parts of the globe. So thanks very much, but we're done with this alliance. And you know, in the broadest, most sort of historically sweeping view, this is stepping away from the legacy of European integration, economic integration, and political integration as the antidote to the violence of World War II.
Okay, so today Theresa May is filing for divorce from the European
right.
Union. Like, how
right.
does that actually work?
So in filing for divorce, we now have a two-year period of negotiation during which Britain has to come to a divorce agreement with the European authorities and has to negotiate a free trade agreement or some kind of interim arrangement. And so Theresa May, she's been acting all along like, oh, it's going to be a negotiation and she doesn't want to show her hand. It's not going to be a negotiation. Essentially, the European authorities are going to coalesce. They're going to come up with a deal. And they may very well present it as a take it or leave it situation, with Britain knowing that whatever deal results has to be ratified by 27 remaining EU member nations. And we saw last year, you know, the EU over 7 years struck what was seen as a very uncontroversial trade deal with Canada. And at the 11th hour, when it looked like it was finally done, one province in Belgium, Wallonia, decided to protect their dairy farmers, and they damn near killed the deal. But the point is, if you are any one of these 27 countries with your own domestic politics, you could decide that the interests of one industry are much greater for your domestic political reasons than getting a free trade agreement between the European Union and Britain.
And they all have veto power?
Yeah. The final details have to be blessed by 27 member nations. That's just an incredible mess. I mean, the hairball is large.
So what if Britain and Europe don't reach a deal by the end of the 2 years?
If at the end of 2 years there's no deal, and if there isn't an interim deal, which seems highly likely at this point, then there's not only total chaos, but anybody who's running a global bank in London learns that a lot of transactions they're handling for clients in Europe are now effectively illegal. I mean, they said, look, we're not going to put ourselves in a position now where we wait and hope that some deal is worked out. But if it doesn't happen, then 2 years from now, we're going to have to say to our, you know, our Dutch client who wants us to use our London base to buy Spanish government debt. Sorry, we can't execute that trade. So, you know, call Goldman because they were smart enough to move their bankers to Paris. So they're going to do it now. And there's a serious debate about how many jobs are going to move. And some of the estimates are enormous. I mean,
how big are the estimates?
Assuming there's no deal, the estimates are, you know, 35,000 jobs leave in the first 2 years, according to Oliver Wyman, this big consulting group. PwC has an 80,000 job number. I mean, this is in the context of 1.1 million financial services jobs in the UK, about 360,000 in London. We're talking about a hit of up to 20 billion pounds, which is like $24 billion in revenue. So this is happening right now.
So Britain wants a good deal, but Europe doesn't want Britain to have too good a deal.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, in the run-up to the vote, the Brexiteers would say things like, well, you know, the Germans, they're the most influential player in Europe, and they have a massive trade surplus with Britain. They're sending over this, you know, lucrative parade of Audis and BMWs and VWs to Britain, and they don't want to have that impeded. They don't want to have tariffs suddenly slapped on,
right,
on German cars sold in Britain. So they'll pull strings and there'll be a trade deal. But since then, Merkel...
Everybody speaks from their own perspective. I say it from my perspective.
...said more strongly and consistently than anybody.
We want an economically strong and prosperous Britain in the European Union.
We're not going to make side deals. And then others have said
British citizens will realize that there is a cost for Brexit, that it's not a divorce where your ex-partner is going to cook for you and you can still see the children.
Listen, you know, if you can get the benefits of being in this club without playing by the rules and while leaving, then why would anybody stay in the club?
We had this agreement that everybody in Europe is in the same boat. We apply the same rules. We move forward in unison. Now, all of a sudden, everyone wants a separate deal. Not
but
only
of course, we know that Europeans, if you're thinking about the cohesion of the European Union, they're worried about the National Front in France. They're worried about the Five-Star Movement in Italy. They're worried about populist movements in Germany and Poland and Hungary. I mean, this is not a moment to hand Britain a deal that allows the next country thinking about going to the exits to have them conclude, oh, yeah, that might work out.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Peter.
Terrific.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Here is what else you need to know today. Just days after House Republicans abandoned their plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, they now say they will try to repeal it.
To my Democrat colleagues who were celebrating Friday's action, I think their celebration is premature because I think we're closer today to repealing Obamacare than we've ever been before, surely even closer than we were Friday. So we're going to keep working. This issue isn't going away.
The Congressional Budget Office has said that repealing Obamacare would leave 23 million Americans without health insurance over the next decade. It would have been 24 million, the CBO said, under the plan to replace it. And
I have all people call me a hero and this, that, and the other. It's not like that.
When a white gunman shot two regulars at a bar in Kansas last month, both immigrants from India, it was a 24-year-old white man at the bar, Ian Grillot, who ran at the shooter. One of the men was killed, the other injured, and Grillot was shot through the hand and chest.
I was just doing what anyone should have done for another human being. It's not about where he's from or his ethnicity. We're all humans. So I just felt I did what was naturally right to do.
The shooter shouted ethnic slurs at the victims and told them they did not belong in America. This week, an Indian American group in Texas presented Grillot $100,000, which it had raised to help him buy a house. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.